When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's kind of fun. You know, normally doing any film or TV show takes at least 2 years of your life. A podcast, you can bust out like a week. So it's nice.
Yeah, no, that's the great thing is like, how do we get so many of these done? And then you're like, it's a conversation. it feels like you are producing content, but it's like, yeah, we talked to some guys for an hour and a half.
Right. That's definitely the low-hanging fruit approach that we found when we did our companion podcast to McMillions. We did it very much conversational-wise. We had a subject from our show come on, and we just cut it down a bit, and we had some excerpts and some deleted scenes that we had in previous that we wanted to include. For the Big Con podcast, I think we kind of went in the opposite direction. We just said, hey, let's do this like highly produced companion piece that's narrative. And it was like doing the whole documentary all over again. And it's been an enormous amount of work. It's been a totally different approach. I think
if we would have known, we just would have done what we did on McMillan.
Before. It's possible.
But even then, I mean, I wrote an entire two seasons of a fully scripted audio drama with Lawrence Fishburne, Lawrence Tate, this amazing cast. And hour-long episodes. First season was 10 episodes. It took us two really relaxed, leisurely weeks to record 10-hour-long episodes. And it was amazing. So even there's still, you know, not having to do hair and makeup, I think, helps. Not having to deal with cameras.
That's true. I think when you compare it to either making a scripted project or if you compare it to making a documentary, it is far easier to put it together. But it's a different style of storytelling. We found that with the most recent podcast that we've been doing for the Big Con, there are certain things that work here that would have never worked in the television documentary series. Mm. And it's just the pace of backstory, some of the additional context that we're providing for our story and about our subjects, it would just like, and the thing is like, we actually tried it. Like some of these things that we tried in the documentary series, we were like, oh yeah, this just doesn't work or it slows us down. Like actually works so well in the podcast. And it's been a really interesting experiment the way that we've been putting this podcast together, because it's a true companion that expands on the documentary series. But it's a true narrative, and they don't cannibalize each other. Like we're not really saying the same. We're kind of talking about the same story, but we're expanding on the story from the documentary series. I don't know. We're
here to talk about movies,
yeah,
Brian.
We're not here to talk about that.
Do you think the podcast would work for people who aren't familiar with the series?
We did design it in a way where you could listen to the podcast and know the entire story and learn a lot and really get the full handle of what it is, but there's just nothing that can replace the visuals of seeing Eric Secon in real life and some of the colorful characters that worked for him and people that were involved in this whole thing. It's just something that needs to be seen to believe. I mean, Eric would create all these crazy commercials. He would just flood the area with these commercials and billboards, and it needs to be seen to be believed. And there was this one point where Eric and his best friend, Dr. Don, who's this local radio DJ, they decided they were going to create their own travel TV show where they just travel around the world and try to pick up on women. And they filmed it. And that's actually in the series. And you definitely have to see that stuff to really believe it.
Mm. Should we tell people who they're talking?
I think we better give them a
hint. Pretend they don't know.
We better give them a hint.
we're really psyched to be talking to James Lee Hernandez and Brian Lazard, who are the creators of the new Apple TV docuseries, four-part docuseries that's out now called The Big Con. And if you live in Appalachia or, you know, my God, if you've ever, I suppose if you've flown over it, you might not have noticed the billboards. But other than that, you have seen an Eric C. Con billboard. And even in Vegas, apparently, a friend of mine was telling me, like he branched out. And it's an amazing story. And I don't want to say too much about it because outside of the fact that it's an incredible kind of crime story, and it feels to me, it's like by the time it's done, it's a great and really kind of moving and yet still kind of an Elmore Leonard kind of movie that you'll have watched. But there are twists. It doesn't go quite where you expect it to go. You're not going to end up feeling about these characters at the end the way you do at the beginning, I think it's safe to say. And honestly, when I was sitting here and I was watching it, it was like, I not only wanted to get you guys on for the usual reasons, I'm also like, if even one of our listeners watches it and is compelled to get involved with the folks who are doing the good work that needs to be done in the aftermath of this story, that would be amazing. Long-winded introduction. But anyway, thank you guys for coming on. They also made the doc McMillions, which is wonderful as well. And we were thrilled to have them come on and not talk about their work with us. So
thank you so much for having us. I mean, we're massive fans of both of you, and it's really an honor to be invited to just hang out and chat movies.
Yeah.
Well, we figure you've been talking about your work for a long time, as everybody does when they're hawking something, and maybe it might be nice for you to talk about somebody else's work.
Exactly. Hey, someday we should have somebody just come on and talk about us. That would be great. Thank you. And
let us know.
Go ahead.
I said, let us know. We're happy to do that.
Yeah. I mean, we could have that actually. Now I'm a little upset at myself that I didn't go that meta with like thinking like, okay, our 10 movies are from you guys. And that's, we're going to talk about those only.
Might be hard to drum up excitement for some of them.
Oh, there's some good ones in there, Joe. But no, it was fun because we chatted a little bit the other day, and you said something really interesting because you know, sometimes people just come in and talk about their favorite movies, and sometimes I try to have people come in and talk about movies on a theme and so forth. But you talked about when you were making this film and when you make your docs, because I think I said, you know, like the obvious one would be like, how about your 10 favorite documentaries? And you said, but you don't think about documentaries when you're making one of these, right? Is that, I mean, tell them what you told me. I thought it was right.
Yeah. I mean, no, that's correct. James and I come from a deep passion for scripted projects. And whenever we, even for McMillions, when we were making that and definitely here for The Big Con, we always talked about scripted projects, movies that were huge influences as our entry point for, you know, creative discussion, for tone, for style, for our approach. And that's even in terms of, you know, the type of feeling that you get at the end of some of these movies were some of the triggers for what we wanted to experiment with here.
That's awesome. Yeah, because it is, it does make you think of great movies when you're watching it, as opposed to just great documentaries, for what it's worth. But yeah, well, let's talk about some. You guys kind of break them up or however you want to just like jump in. Who wants to go sure. first and
well,
toss out?
I think that, first of all, we were excited by this invitation to talk about some crucial movies that influenced us. And we had a really hard time to narrow it down as and by the way, I hate
Joe, I've never heard that before.
sorry. I actually hate like top lists, right? When people are like, oh, what's your favorite song or your favorite movie? Like sure. I have like a visceral reaction to that. Personally.
Me too.
I don't mind them personally.
I mean, because I have different feelings, different times, and it kind of comes and goes, and they're clustered in different things. But I think we narrowed down 10, five from each of us, and there's definitely overlap here. But these were films that we thought were not only crucial to shaping our influences as filmmakers, but were definite discussion points when making The Big Con. And we figured that would be the ideal way to put these 10 movies out there for us.
Awesome. Let's pick one and begin.
I think the first one to start with, this list could easily have been like my top movies of all time. But one that we really drew a ton of inspiration from is, I guess we'll start off with The Big Lebowski. Mm-hmm. Like when we first had the meeting with HBO about McMillions, we were talking to the Lisa and Nancy who run HBO Docs, and they tried to narrow down, okay, so what doc is this like? And we really couldn't find anything, because part of the pitch was, it's going to be a true crime doc. It's going to be about basically like this big fraud. Nobody really dies. Nobody's wrongfully accused and jailed for 20 years. And it's going to be funny. So the only thing we could point to was a Coen Brothers movie. Like this is the type of really interesting, quirky characters that are funny just because of their decision-making. We're not making fun of them. We're just allowing them and their decisions to be funny and having a very serious moral undertone. And that was really the only way that we could describe it that made sense.
Yeah, I can see that. Yes.
I should also point out, though, we did not take the title The Big Con from The Big Lebowski. We actually had a different title in mind for this for the better part of a year and a half, maybe even 2 years.
What was that?
It originally was going to be called Mr. Social Security, because Eric C. Kahn, that's what he called himself. All his billboards, all his commercials that always say Mr. Social Security, but because Apple TV Plus is worldwide, they don't know what Social Security is really outside of the States. So
yeah,
it had to be a little bit of a wider grasp.
I also feel like it's one of those things where like it's not just lying on the table. It's like an elephant on top of a tiny little table. Like how are you not going to get Kahn into that somehow?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, it's so obvious. You almost don't have a choice.
we're big fans of the title. So it worked out.
It's great. It
worked out quite nicely.
It's good stuff. And yeah, you can see that too. I mean, and again, like I said, I also went to a lot of Elmore Leonard, especially as it got deeper into his story and kind of the second half of the series, but it had that kind of that vibe. And or even somehow like the James Bond ad that he recreates, that does feel very somehow Coen Brothers.
I mean,
really, I never left.
Love, however, though, that you picked up on how you feel about these characters at the beginning of the series is going to be different than how you feel about them at the end. And in a lot of ways, like that arc building is definitely inspired by great scripted projects. And we love that experience when you go into a movie and you see someone have that change, right? Where they grow as a character. And it should feel that way. I mean, in a documentary series, you know, we realize like we meet Eric kind of at one point in his life. And then at the end of the series, we were with him at a different, and he does change. And so do a few of the other characters in a lot of ways. But
very much so. I mean, my feelings about a lot of the characters on sort of either side of this thing change radically over the course of it. I would definitely say, without giving anything away, I mean, what's interesting is that, you know, I mean, it's four episodes. Shit, we're talking about their work. We'll get back to that in a minute. To other people's work. But you know, if you get to the end of the second episode, you're like, okay, what's left? And for me, I was like, well, I would very much like to know about the people that he took in, but I can't think. And then you've got two more hours and everything that you believe about this thing is going to change. And that feels fairly ballsy in a miniseries. I feel like in a 2-hour movie, it's like, I'm invested, I'm here for an hour, but in something where people are going to, well, I guess they're binging, but you know, where they're like, oh my God, please do stick with it. Cause if you think it's one thing, it's not, it really isn't. And that's something I really loved about it.
Oh, well, thank you. It is something that we obviously, as you guys know, like we go over story time constantly. We're just always messing with it. And there was a version where we meet the claimants and you know, see some of the fallout at the very beginning of the entire show. But a thing that we wanted to do was, like Brian said, like flip your idea of who yep. Eric is and what happens with all of this. And also, Eric is just such a big, larger-than-life character. We wanted you to feel the same way that people in the area felt. Because for a long time, yeah. Eric was a hero. He yeah. was helping people get benefits that needed them. And then over time, they started to be disillusioned and start to realize what was actually going on. And we wanted people to experience that same roller coaster that people in the community went on.
Yeah, no, and you definitely pulled it off. But enough. Let's talk about... I'm really sorry, Joe. What others?
All right. Boogie Nights is...
Oh, yeah.
From, yep. from a list of... I mean, we talk about Boogie Nights all the time. Just the tone and the world, the environment, the backdrop of that movie. It's also one of those movies you can just watch over and over and over mm-hmm. again. It just, even though it's a longer movie, the arc, the style, and just obviously the characters are incredible. But some of the poppy influences, like at times where it would jump away to like Dirk Diggler, right? When they're in the hot tub and he's like describing his name and it, you know, pops up under, with fireworks, or the little, mini, like ad that runs, you know, for the porn movie.
Right. Oh, right. The mini documentary.
Exactly.
That, yeah.
And they're watching it and loving it. But, yeah. So when I moved to Los Angeles in 2005, and one of the first, experiences I had in like the few months that I was here is I met with Robert Elswit, and I had loved that movie I saw in the theater, and I had no idea. An old girlfriend was like, "Hey, you want to go see this movie, Boogie Nights?" I was thinking like some like Saturday Night Fever type movie, and it floored me. I was just like, "You can do this in a movie?" It was like happiness in a way. Like when I saw that, I was like, ugh. I love that movie, but it was, you know, you felt like I'd never seen a movie like that at the time.
Well, it feels, you feel like you're part of a community in a world that you just sort of walk into, and it's fully formed with all these characters. I mean, you're a fan of that, Joe, right?
Sure.
Yeah. I mean, that one seems pretty irresistible. I love it. And again, you can sort of see it. It's like, it's that. Every character is distinct. Every character is interesting. Every character is funny without being mocked. Absolutely. Absolutely. I love that flick.
Yeah. And that opening shot is just incredible.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Oh, yeah.
That closing one's a little startling too. That's
yeah. It just, there's just so many funny things, and they just keep coming back and back. Like, we don't have to get into it, but I remember the every single time I'm trying to remember the character's name, that she's always having sex with somebody, and
it's William H. Macy's wife.
And every single, it's like every scene that you see him in, it's a recurring joke, and it's hilarious. But you seeing his demise and seeing the effect that it has on him, like at first it's like, oh, come on, and then it just gets worse and worse and worse, but it's also hilarious at the same time.
Because that just goes from funny to tragic so quick.
And that funny to tragic is at the root of a lot of the things that James and I are attracted to in these types of stories. McMillian's, yeah. Like our whole idea was, you know, how can you go from humor to tragedy in an instant? And mm-hmm. we, you know, certainly wanted to lean into that here as well.
Life seems to be able to do that really easily. It does seem to be something that movies have a hard time with sometimes, I think. But
I think it's something movie executives have a hard time with.
Yes. Better point. Correct.
That is something that we've really fought for. And in general, I mean, it's really nice to be able to point to things now and say, like, you can watch McMillions, you can watch The Big Con and see that shift. But it is a really difficult line to walk because you can very quickly become a mockery of yourself if you're trying to do that and you take this moment that's supposed to be very weighty and heavy. And we've all seen scenes that have that where it's pressure filled, it's serious, and you need to live in that moment, but they throw one little button joke at the end to relieve the pressure. And you should actually like trust in your audience and just trust in the idea of you just let that linger for a little bit, like stay in that world, let people feel something so they understand how serious it is.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, and Joe's right too. Of course, I mean, audiences can handle that. It's just that it often confounds the people who are. What would you say?
Paying for it.
Yeah, paying for it. That's the ticket.
You're writing a check. Yeah, I'll do that edit right now, guys.
I mean, one of my favorites. I don't know. There's an amazing Bobcat Goldthwait movie called World's Greatest Dad. I don't know if you've.
Oh, it's great. Yes.
Yeah, and I mean, Robin Williams just gives the performance of a lifetime in there. And there's a scene in that movie, and I don't want to spoil it, where Robin Williams has to just react to the most horrifying thing a father could ever have to deal with, and he pours his heart out on film. It's incredibly powerful and moving. It's also screamingly funny at the same time.
Yeah.
And
right.
I love that.
Yeah,
we're
fans.
Yeah,
that's a great movie. We also talk about Windy City Heat a lot.
Oh man, so crazy coincidence is that during the making of McMillions, we kept watching this movie that Bobcat Goldthwait made called Windy City Heat, and it was this crazy like mockumentary or documentary where him and his friends set up one of their friends who's very gullible, thinking he's making the biggest blockbuster on the planet, and they're just making fun of him the whole time. And we would always watch that going filming and talk about it. And Brian and I would just laugh like hysterically at it. And then when it was time to do the recreations for McMillions, we had somebody suggest, they're like, you got to talk to this woman, Tasha. She's amazing. Like, we think she'd really be perfect for you guys. And we met with her, and it's Bobcat's daughter. And so we like got to meet Bobcat. He came to set one day. When we got into Sundance, he came to the premiere at Sundance. It was like the full like circle, life completing itself of getting to meet him and talk to him after laughing at his movie so much.
Yes.
I can't talk about that movie without falling over laughing.
Yeah. No, we've been through, we've had him on the show actually a couple times now, and he's just been a wonderful, wonderful guest. Giant fan. Well, cool. Let's do another one.
All right. Back to the list. All right. So this next one really helped define, I don't know, in a certain sense, the slickness in a way that we like to try and go about things. And just in general, huge fan of the director, Ocean's 11, but the one from 2001 directed by Steven Soderbergh.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and I don't think anybody's ever brought up the original Ocean's 11 is a favorite movie.
It's not a favorite movie, but I like that movie.
Do you really?
I do. I think it's a lot of fun.
It's definitely better.
The original is great. I mean, it's the Rat Pack at its peak. And I've had EO 11 stuck in my head probably since I was a kid. My mom and grandma showed me that for the first time. But with, in general, just with Steven Soderbergh's style, it's fascinating because it's very smooth, very slick, but still feels very real. It doesn't feel like it's overly flashy. It doesn't feel like he's trying to force himself or his version of everything into your mind. You're just sort of there living in the moment, but in such a stylistic way. And that's a big influence on us for all of these things, especially when you're thinking about these frauds and these capers with all these different pieces that are involved in it. And we put a lot of thought into just how we shoot the entire thing, everything from in McMillions, we made sure that we shot people that were like involved with law enforcement. were shot slightly different than people that were shot that were on the other side of the law. And the same thing with The Big Con. With The Big Con, we really looked at it as what we're dealing with Eastern Kentucky, an area that's often very forgotten because of, you know, coal country kind of dying. And how can we be very true to the area and show the beauty of it all while the mystery at the same time?
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's also interesting too, the way your visual representation of that area changes over the course of the series as well. Because again, without getting too far into it, I'm sort of halfway through and I'm like, I've been there and they're making it look, they're sort of not showing us some of the things here. And then you start to see the kind of more kind of graphic realities of the poverty there. It's like, all right, they're doing this on purpose. I like that.
We tricked you.
Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Well, cool. How about another one?
I'm sure this has been brought up many, many times, but
not by you, though. Brian.
Okay.
Not by
you. That's all that matters.
That's all that matters.
That's right.
Pulp Fiction is still to this day for us one of those great high movies that was so influential when it came out, but still to this day is incredible to watch and rewatch over again. It is such a fun ride. It's so brilliantly structured. The way he plays with time, the tonality, the characters, just the punchiness. It's like, it's one of those movies that, like, we, whether we want it to or not, it it seeps in and becomes an influence for, you know, how we approach things. I mean, Quentin Tarantino is, for, you know, one of the best filmmakers, I believe, of our generation. And and just what he does is so unique in his style and his tone. And I remember when I first saw that movie in a theater, similar to, you know, Boogie Nights, I was like, what? Like, how do you even think of this? Like, how does this even come out of your brain? Right. And I think that in sort of over the years and, you know, James and I spending the time that we do, you realize, like, just it's dedication, right? Yep. It's persistence. And it's just taking stab after stab after stab of trying to crack the story in the best way that you can think of that has a sense of originality and fun. And that's, you know, in a lot of ways at the root of, you know, what we like to do. And when we formed our company, Fun Meter, it was really designed to focus on projects like this, even if they're not projects that we're solely directing. But in this case, obviously we look at it as how many different ways can we crack this open? How many different ways can we find that tone, that right balance of humor and tragedy? How can we infuse a voice into this that we haven't seen or heard before and just challenge ourselves and each other to make this the best version? I mean, we had Eric Kahn's manuscript provided to us exclusively for the document, you know, for us. And we immediately were like, we have to include this.
We have to use as much of this as humanly possible. And how often do you get to see the true inner workings of a person? Like this is really how he thought everything went. Some of it's true, some of it is embellished, some of it, who knows if it happened.
Right.
But it's very often, I mean, in general, it's always really a thing that I always think is crazy is that you think of like the human brain as a camera, but actually your brain is just building its own reality at the time. So you're going to see things totally different than somebody else. And that's how he saw the world. And it was quite cinematic. So, you know, we were very lucky to work with Boyd Holbrook, who came in and actually read.
He does an amazing. Boyd Holbrook does a great job reading the manuscript. Yes.
And a crazy thing about him is he is actually born and raised in this area of Eastern Kentucky. He's from Prestonsburg. Right. He grew up, you know, driving around, seeing Eric Kahn billboards his entire life.
Sure.
And so like to have him, and he's such a phenomenal actor. And I mean, his voice, oh my God, just. Yeah.
So he lived with the character. He'd lived with the character for a while. Yes.
He knew Eric. He learned a lot from watching the documentary series that he didn't know, but I mean, that idea of including the manuscript was something that we hadn't really seen done before like this. Like we've know, there was a Michelle McNamara documentary where like part of her book, right, was read.
Oh, and it
was
read, I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
I'll Be Gone in the Dark.
Oh, and, okay. Yeah. Sure. Yes.
Right. And they had an actor read from that. And we've seen like different things being read before. But when we approached this, we didn't want it to be read. Even though it was a manuscript, we approached it with Boyd as like, hey, in not to mimic Eric's voice, but to really take you into this, like hanging out at a bar, everyone's kind of leaning in and Eric is telling a story. And we really worked at trying to find that right voice and that right tone for each specific manuscript. And we also were like, is this going to feel weird? Like, it was part of the original pitch from the get-go. Like, we're going to include this manuscript and
we were determined to, resource.
To make it work. But we didn't know exactly how we'd introduce it. How it would feel next to other things. And that's, going back to Tarantino, just like you just have to keep trying things until you find the right, just that right balance. And
it's funny because actually that film hasn't come up a lot on the show, which is interesting to me because I would assume it would more. And actually before, and I have one thought because I love what you're saying about it and how it affected you. Before that, though, my wife would kill me if you didn't ask. How do you know, did the dog make it back?
Oh, yes. So the dog did make it back
We know this? Okay. All right. Because that figures heavily in her. The thing that drove me nuts during the sort of initial explosion of Quentin, from Reservoir Dogs through to Pulp Fiction especially, was how many filmmakers took the lesson that what you need to do now is make movies about pop culture referencing hitmen wearing black suits, and how few of them got the message that you're getting, and that you should make a movie that just includes everything you love and you should find the best way to tell it. You could immediately tell the people, obviously, who took the wrong lesson, I think, from him, because most of them aren't around anymore either. I think.
Yeah. Actually, there was an interesting story that I heard Quentin talk about at some point. I call him, Quentin, because we're buddies. Actually, I think everybody calls him Q. But he talked about how people told him his influence on movies and he didn't realize it. And he said, in the movie Bad Boys, there's two guys, there are two cops waiting on a stakeout to go inside and bust somebody. And they have this exchange about, like, I don't know, food or something random, like something on TV. And someone pointed out, like, that never would have happened or been allowed if you didn't make Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs, because people now think that the extra character development dialogue is something interesting and it's not just all action and crazy stuff happening at all times. So it's interesting to have that kind of impact, which then brings me to another movie by Quentin Tarantino. And this is referenced just in the sense that, so Kill Bill is, he thinks of it as one movie. It's volume one, volume two. But the influence for that, especially in the world of documentary, is that nothing is off limits. That movie has color, black and white. It has unreal, phenomenal fight scenes. It's a Western. It has animation. You can go any direction with any different way to tell the story. And it really is an art form that can be bent and even rules can be broken from time to time. And that's something that Brian and I lean into very much, where, with telling these stories in a documentary, normally it's sit down interviews, verite footage, and some archival. And the thing that we like to do is put you there in the moment. We don't want you to just sit there and watch a story that was told about something 10 years ago and know that everybody made it out okay. I mean, outside of the person obviously sitting there telling the story. So we rely a lot on recreations, archival, interesting, fun stock footage, verite, just everything that we can to be able to put you in that moment so you can feel like you're a fly on the wall when all of this stuff actually happened.
Yeah, and I love some. In fact, there were some shots where I wasn't even sure if they were recreations or just shots of, like, am I wrong? It's a great technique, and you didn't invent it, but you used it beautifully of doing kind of recreations where the camera's never quite on somebody's face or they're always kind of out of focus and you're using actors. But there are one or two shots where I wasn't even sure if it was part of a recreation or if it was just like one of the interview subjects, like getting up and walking off camera or something. But it's just, you did a great job with those. They're delightful.
It's funny. There was a few people who thought that our Damian Paletta, who is the Wall Street Journal reporter, that we use him in all of the recreations that involve him. And that's actually an actor.
I think, yeah, he was one of the ones where I was genuinely, I thought, okay, well, they're not having it. But you did in a way, like, I didn't notice that in scenes where the character was quote unquote acting. I just sort of noticed in scenes where he was sort of standing somewhere and looking at something. I thought, oh, they just got him to do this. But that's amazing. Yeah. He's almost dead ringer.
Even our colorist, when we told him that, like, no, that's an actor. Who had been looking at this day in, day out was surprised. when we made, and really appreciate the compliment, because we do spend a lot of time thinking about how to, really integrate and connect archival and recreation. And we have a phenomenal production designer who we work with, who worked with us on McMillions, and I always butcher her name. So James is going to do it.
What? Who?
Our production designer, Ariel.
Oh, Ariel Ness Cohen.
Yeah. See, I always want to say Khan.
I thought you said him. I was like,
oh, no. I always want to say Khan.
Dustin?
So, oh. Yeah. But Ariel, and I'm so terrible with names. I'm on a first name basis with everybody because I can't retain that half of people's names. And Ariel is phenomenal and will work with us so intensely at ensuring that we have references from archival. And she comes up with such great creative inventive ways to make sure that it looks just like the archival photograph. Mm-hmm. And one of the last scenes in episode 4, not to give anything away, but he's in a restaurant and we have an archival photo, and it just, you know, we flash the photo, but we have the archival, you know, the recreations that we filmed there, and she was really proud of it. We were really proud of it. And we did something similar on McMillions, and I think Munich was actually one of our inspirations for that, because
For sure.
How if you remember in Munich, there's a scene where the real archival is playing on a television scene on a television of one of the terrorists who's popping his head out of the window or the door frame, right, of a balcony.
Right.
And then
you see a recreation outside that.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, you're seeing the scene. Steven Spielberg, you know, just beautifully composed this shot where, it's timed so perfectly with the actor, stepping out on this balcony, just as there's a live feed of the camera that's feeding into the newsroom or to the news station, what's going on in that TV. And it's just a beautiful use of, you using archival with something that you shot. And we love to do that in any way we can to like blend those lines and immerse you even more.
Yeah, no, I love that technique actually. And Joe, they're talking about their work again. I'm sorry.
Sorry.
All right. Can't control these men.
Okay.
You just keep letting them slide back into it.
I know. It's getting out of control.
All right. We'll stop.
I'll just bleep out every mention of the documentary.
You have edit control. So you can just cut all that
just
stuff.
Cut it down. And pretty soon it's be like, we're like Ocean's 11, The Big Lebowski, Pulp Fiction. And thanks for
having
us. We
found these two men on the street and we asked them what their favorite movies are. We hope them someday they'll
make
a film.
They just talked about themselves.
We can shotgun blast, the remaining.
Okay. So we're going to take a minute here, and Joe is going to go off and chastise Brian and James, whip them into shape. And I am going to take advantage of this moment to thank our sponsors, our wonderful sponsors at moviesunlimited.com, who are the movie collectors website. As you know, they're not just big fans of our show. They feature many of the movies we discuss here, so you can easily find them and add them to your collection. Hard media, folks. The heck with streaming. You never know. You never know. They'll take it away from you. You get that little ball spinning. It's terrible. When you own your favorites, you'll watch what you want, when you want it, and there's usually a ton of great content and bonus features, director's commentary, deleted scenes, all sorts of goodness. Even screenwriter's commentary sometime. So buy your favorites at moviesunlimited.com. If you go to the Trailers from Hell website, you'll see their banner. Or if you go to moviesunlimited.com directly, you'll see the Trailers from Hell banner. And you click on that, find any episode, and there will be a list of all the movies we talk about on the show, linking to where you can get them at moviesunlimited.com. So click on that, go to their site, buy your favorites, moviesunlimited.com, the Movie Collectors website, where shipping is always free on orders over $50.
Welcome to From Beneath the Hollywood Sign. If you love old movies, Hollywood history, or the golden age of filmmaking, you've come to the right place. This is the podcast that talks about amazing stories of Tinseltown from another era and fascinating conversations with writer-producer Steve Kubine and actress-writer Nan McNamara.
One particular argument, he ended up dislocating Ava's jaw. Ava, she was such a tough cookie. Rather than cry or scream or anything like that, she was...
Or call the police,
like she should have, exactly. Exactly. What does she do? She takes an ashtray and she knocks him over the head and knocks him unconscious. That's how she fought back. She didn't know what to do, so she called Louis B. Mayer. I think I've killed Howard Hughes. What do I do?
Revisit a time when the pictures were still big and everyone was ready for their close-up. When you want Tyrone Power instead of Tom Hardy, Jennifer Jones instead of Jennifer Lawrence, or Robert Mitchum rather than Robert Pattinson, then From Beneath the Hollywood Sign is the gin joint for you.
So, Fargo.
Oh, yeah.
We reference Fargo all the time. The tone, just the dark comedy and the ridiculousness of the characters. And that, I mean, I don't want to say like it's a perfect movie, but it's up there.
Yeah, that's, I love that film.
Yeah. And, you know, the fact that, you know, the series that kind of came afterwards that could just continue to build off of it was so impressive. And
yeah,
not to say that we were trying to do something similar with our companion podcast, but you know, there is this element of how, you know, the world, there, as crazy as the world is, there's so much more to explore in the world.
Yeah. And that's sort of one of the, I mean, it's weird because it is sort of a dopey kind of like old Marvel Comics conceit, but sort of, yeah, that's what that TV show did. It sort of created the idea of a shared Fargo universe, you know?
Right. So next on the list, actually, speaking of Steven Spielberg, is Catch Me If You Can. Catch Me If You Can is unreal. And one of the main things that I love about it is such a great balance of motivations, like mm-hmm. the intention and obstacles of it. But really, you very much believe that Leonardo DiCaprio's character, Frank Abagnale, really was driven to live this life because of the way he was raised. You see that relationship that his father had with his mother. I mean, right. Christopher Walken, obviously phenomenal in that. And you see this then push-pull relationship where, you know, Tom Hanks is hunting him down the entire time. And at a certain point, you realize this is Frank Abagnale's only real friend. Like, strangely, the person trying to hunt him down is his equal on the opposite side. And they're weirdly bonded. There's a kinship there, even though, you know, Tom Hanks is just hell-bent on taking this kid down. And you take that balance and it, like all of the crazy hijinks of it and all the things he goes through just totally makes sense in a way that it doesn't seem farcical at all. And I mean, you know, it is a true story. And it's just great to see that it constantly has that connection to the motivation of it. It all means something. It all works for a reason. It's just not there for just fun and games.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny. We haven't talked about too much of the show, but I'm kind of a Spielberg skeptic about a lot of the time, a lot more than some people are. I don't know. I mean, you know, I love the ones you think I love, but
I think that's one of his most underrated movies.
But I was going to say that is one that I love unequivocally. It's just a fantastic film and really caught me unawares because, you know, I was like, he's working with Tom Hanks again. It looked kind of slight. It's, you know, I don't even think I think somebody dragged me off to see it, which is always yeah. It's always the best way to see a good movie too. Right.
But it's a great point. And that's really what I'm getting at is that on the surface, mm-hmm. it seems like a light and fluffy movie, but they're really serious, like father, son, mother, son, parent issues at play that he's getting across within this entire thing. And to the point where Tom Hanks all of a sudden becomes his father figure. It's just a really interesting mind game that it plays yeah. throughout the entire thing.
It's also one of his shorter movies, right?
Clocks in at only 2 hours.
I think it actually is under. I mean, I can't. Every time I think of that movie, the score also just like immediately just plays in the background in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, there's a lot of similarities to Frank Abagnale and Eric Kahn in the sense that there is this, you know, they didn't have a lot of friends,
right?
But in a lot of ways, like they couldn't help themselves, right? Very intelligent, very charismatic, and just like sometimes when opportunity is in front of you, what do you do with it?
Right.
You see how they did that? How they snuck back into their...
I know.
We'll
be up all night.
It's totally my fault.
By the way, that movie's 2 hours and 21 minutes long. Catch me if you can.
Is it really?
That's how good it is.
Breezes
right through those 2 hours and 21 minutes. I could have gone for 2 hours and 41
minutes. Unlike Munich. But yeah.
That's true.
Munich's a little long.
Okay, next up, Delicatessen.
Oh, yeah. Janae.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm okay. So I get there's the whole sort of interesting community of disparate and unique characters. But from there, it's a fucking masterpiece. Love that movie.
Yeah. It's one of those, films. I think I don't know if I saw it in a theater or if I saw it on video. I had a roommate of mine that worked at this small little indie rental like movie house in Cincinnati, Ohio, where I grew up.
And was his name Quentin?
And it was just one of those there's movies like this out there. Like at the time that I saw it, I had not been exposed to it. And it was like almost a little, like, I think I just like watched a Wallace and Gromit film for the first time. And I was like, what is this? And it was like at that, you know, those, you know, formative years and university when you're just like, you're learning a whole lot of new things. And all of a sudden you experience a film like this and the humor, the pacing, mm-hmm. the editing, it was actually, to me, one of those critical defining films that made me want to spend time as an editor. And I did for a great deal of my career. And even James and I now still like any of our projects, like we're always in there cutting and working on the edit with the editors. It's like part of, at least for me especially, it's just part of how we shape story. So I love that movie.
Yeah, so much. And I've been such a fan of so many of the other films that he's done too. Even
same. Though. Yeah.
Yeah.
You only gave us 10 though. So.
Yeah. What was the, oh my God, I was just thinking about the other day and I can't remember the title. Joe, what was his 3D movie that, that Harvey butchered and fucked up? I love that we're allowed to say these things now publicly.
he's in jail. He can't.
He's in jail. That's right. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Oh my God, what was it called? It was based on a book. This is embarrassing. This is embarrassing.
Well, just look them up on IMDb.
I am. It's like, it's moving very slowly. And I was telling these guys the other day that I have like a Wikipedic knowledge of film. And now I'm, it's like that 3D film he did, Young and Prodigious, T.S. Spivitt.
How did you just know that? That's like brilliant.
I pulled these things, yes. But it was, there was some kind of like Harvey was going to cut it and not release it in 3D. And if somehow contractually Jeanne was like, that was one option, is he would give it a bigger release if it wasn't in 3D and if he got to cut it. And if he didn't cut it, it would show in like one theater in LA for a week. And God bless him. He said, fuck you to Harvey. And I got to see it in the Pax House 3D. And it's like, it's a delightful film. I think the movie itself is probably not one of his strongest, but you know, a Jeanne film in 3D is like, of course you need to see that, right? And
I don't think.
Yeah. I had no intention of doing this, but I do a podcast with Joe Dante, who also made a 3D movie called The Hole. He hates when I do this, that if you do ever get a chance to see in 3D, just it's if you have not, I don't know.
Have seen it in 3D and I loved it.
It's just so great to see somebody using that that medium thoughtfully, as opposed to just.
Well, that didn't last long, actually.
Yeah, but you know, you got one in there, though, Joe.
I got before they started doing it all on computers. I mean, the appeal for me was that I got to do it in quote real 3D, cameras, and real 3D experts and stuff. But then I just shoot it and put it through the computer and like we do with the cartoons, it'll be fine. That's what passes for 3D then.
Yeah.
Well, that's the ultra like frustrating thing about it is that nowadays if 3D is done, they shoot it like a regular, they shoot it 2D, composed for just regular 2D, and they slice it all up and make it 3D. What you did was actually design shots in three dimensions, like for the form.
That's what you're supposed to do. I mean, that's how I always thought it was supposed to work. I mean, that's one of my favorite 3D movies was Dial M for Murder, which is a stage play. But when you see it in 3D, it's not the same movie as it is in 2D because of the spatial relationships between the characters.
I love that. It feels like you can reach your hand in and be in the world. As a kid growing up, you see, the first thing I think of is Jaws 3D. And it's just, let's shoot this normal. And then like all of a sudden this tooth is coming out towards your face and coming back in. It's like this like kitschy, I don't know, just like doing it just to say you did it. But I really enjoyed.
Oh, there is an amazing shot of there of somebody getting eaten shot from inside the shark's mouth.
True. I don't mean to shortchange that shot. I was just thinking
someone
should
do a doc in 3D. And then I realized, and my friend Eric Nelson, who produced it would kill me if I didn't, but of course, Werner Herzog did Cave of Gun,
which is actually pretty cool in 3D.
Yeah.
So I worked on the Katy Perry, 3D movie. Part of Me. And we did that with Paramount, and a lot of it was shot, or at least the performance stuff was shot in 3D, but we did dimensionalize certain shots, that had been shot in 2D or were incorporated. And that process was such a fascinating one to be a part of. But that was aside from just wanting to work on a studio film at that time, being able to work on a 3D project, I was super excited about. And that's a great use in documentary. A concert, just nothing like watching it in 3D.
Well, let's say, I confess I have not seen it. I'm behind on my Katy Perry concert films, but I need to.
It's YouTube, really good.
The YouTube concert film is great at 3D also. The YouTube concert film in 3D.
Did they do one in 3D? Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Sorry about that. I'm told we're getting close to the end, Jess. Right,
we'll go super fast.
We'll speed through the end of it. Although with a poster in the background of you, Josh, we should have definitely picked a certain James Bond movie, since one of our characters, Eric Sikon, tried to turn himself into James Bond. Although I personally would rather think of it more of like Pink Panther style. Like there's definitely
a
Blake Edwards basically influences any decision I make ever when it comes to film or TV or anything. But the last one on my list is Goodfellas. And, you know, it's just tough to not put it on the list because ultimately that's always my go-to favorite film because that was the first time I'd really seen anything like that before. I mean, I'm half Mexican, half Italian. So my grandma on my Italian side, like made me watch that almost like I was watching like my family history somehow. I don't know, who knows, but, to be able to see Scorsese, you know, manipulate time with starting off in the middle and then doing freeze frames. And even the way that he shows, when Henry Hill's wife goes to visit him in prison, and then she scans the book and the way that that's shot to see the name of Janice, the woman he was cheating on her with, like all of those things influence. Constantly in documentary filmmaking, you're showing documents and like, how can you make documents look sexy on camera? And so those are things that we reference of trying to make you feel like you're reading it or at least giving you some movement, some excitement of looking at FBI documentation, which tends to not be the most exciting thing.
That's great. Do you guys know the Henny Youngman story about that movie?
The
most incredible water bottle. And then like every time they get to the end, there's Henny Youngman and he keeps blowing his most famous line.
I love that.
Yeah. Such a good one. And Brian, are you gonna walk us out on one?
One last on the list. And to be honest, it was actually kind of it was hard to pick this last one because there was a tie between a doc project or one of my favorite movies, Children of Men, it just tonally is one of the most brilliant movies, I think, that I don't know if it's underrated, but it certainly is one of those movies you could just watch. The filmmaking in that movie was incredible, and just the
it feels
struggle.
Like everyone who's seen it loves it and gets it, but it did not get seen by enough people.
So our technical last one here is The Imposter, because The Imposter is a documentary film was done a number of years ago, and it was one of those first true like highly stylized recreation films. And it was done so well. And you couldn't tell, hey, is it the actor, the same person who's playing the actual person sitting down and doing the interview? And it was so well done, so well executed. And really, in a lot of ways, one of the first films that we can kind of point to that really elevated the recreation format for documentary filmmaking. And we're excited to be, part of that, process of like, hey, how can we, raise the bar? And, we understand that recreations and documentaries aren't for everyone. And we don't necessarily intend to like do them in every future project we do.
I feel like there was a time though, sort of way back when, I remember I was sort of like, much, much younger and sort of reading about documentaries and all this, that it was just like, it was a line you do not cross. And,
sure.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things that were just considered like Nanook of the North is a fraudulent film because now it's the sort of doors are open. It's pretty amazing. I mean, I think it's storytelling. You don't get any grief for that, do you?
No. Yeah. I don't know about grief.
A little bit, especially on McMillions, but on this, people have become more accepting of it, but it took a while for people to get past the Unsolved Mysteries version of recreations.
Right.
And
yes.
No offense to Unsolved Mysteries. Not the,
Yes.
Pioneers. Classic. They are pioneers.
Yeah. Yes, correct.
much as you guys are, but
yeah, I don't think they shot that stuff anamorphic.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. We've been talking to Brian Lazart and James Lee Hernandez of The Big Con, which is on Apple TV right now. Highly, highly recommended. And also, like, if you're as moved as I was by it, my wife is, we'll put some stuff up on the website too. There's a couple places you can go to kind of help out the folks who are doing the good work. of kind of picking up some of the wreckage left behind from this chaotic story. But yeah, this has been absolutely wonderful. Really, really appreciate you coming on. Do you know what you're doing next?
Say
yes or no, because obviously
yes.
We do. It's something else that we're doing with Apple TV Plus, and I don't know exactly what it'll be out, but it's going to be another wild ride.
And it's a documentary.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Well, good luck with this. Good luck with that. And thank you for coming to talk.
Thank you.
Thanks, Josh, Joe. Thank you so much. Thanks for being an inspiration for us.
Yeah.
Thanks, Guys.
A pleasure.
Our show was recorded from several well-stocked bunkers. We can't wait to get back to beautiful downtown Burbank. We're the official podcast of TrailersFromHell.com, the best damn movie website there is. Our engineer is the composer Don Barrett, who also transmogrified, produced, and created our theme song. This is Josh Olson for The Movies That Made Me. Stay safe out there, folks.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.